from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Starting in January, California homeowners can now build up to 2 in-law units on their land. Several recently signed bills loosen regulations that restricted the size, parking requirements, and location of accessory dwelling units. Supporters say the new laws will dramatically increase housing production across the state. But some neighborhood associations and suburban communities think the state has gone too far and is trying to do away with single-family zoning, a mainstay of the California dream. That's all next. Join us after this news. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. California leaders want the state to build 500,000 new homes each year until 2025, a rate of housing construction that has never happened before. And some legislators think the state can reach this goal by easing the path for single-family homeowners to build accessory dwelling units, often called in-law or granny flats, on their properties. To that end, the state just approved a number of bills that allow construction of backyard units and garage conversions. And in this hour, we're going to talk about the bills and hear why some residents are worried that the changes will negatively have impact on the character of single-family neighborhoods. Let me tell you who's joining us for the hour. We want to welcome first Liam Dillon. He's a reporter with the LA Times. He covers affordable housing. And Liam Dillon, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have Karen Chappell, who's here with us in studio, and welcome her back to Forum. She's professor of City and Regional Planning at University of California, Berkeley. She is also someone who has one of these, what they used to call granny units, in her backyard. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Michael. Great to be back.
And Susan Kirsch is also with us this morning, founder and former president of Livable California, a group which advocates for local power in housing. And welcome to the program.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Good to have you here, and glad you are all here and assembled. And let me begin, if I may, Liam Dillon, with you. I know there's been, as you pointed out in a recent article you did, chipping away over the past 4 years at zoning only for single-family homes, particularly with making it easier for these so-called granny flats or converting garages into residential space or building more small, upstanding, freestanding homes. These new bills, though, outline them for us and give us a quick sense of crystallizing what they are. We're talking about a quartet of bills here.
The whole collection, and as you mentioned, this sort of started 4 years ago with lawmakers saying we want to prevent or stop cities from putting up what they believe to be roadblocks to construction of these accessory dwelling units, casitas, backyard homes, whatever your favorite term is for these. And so they began by taking a look at changing things like parking requirements, also fees that utilities or cities may charge homeowners to build these units. And then most recently, the bills that passed this year now do things like ensuring that all property owners or the vast majority in single-family areas will be able to build a backyard home of at least 800 square feet, as well as being able to convert a garage, office, or spare room into a third living space.
So this is going to spur a lot more housing in the midst of this housing crisis. What about unseen consequences, or for that matter, if we can look with a periscope, seen and anticipated consequences?
Yeah, so from what I'm hearing, some concerns from, sort of neighborhood activists and local government leaders are predominantly concerned that they will no longer be able to kind of tailor some of these policies to their specific communities. And so maybe one neighborhood may have more of a need for parking than another. The state is essentially saying basically the need for housing overrides those concerns.
And we're talking about something which will take effect the 1st of January, I know, but it means that the only exceptions to this in terms of accessory dwellings will be for health or safety reasons, which would include properties in high wildfire areas?
Yeah, exactly. It's always hard to see or hard to know exactly how these sorts of bills will be implemented. Obviously, we have over 500 cities and counties in the state, but generally speaking, that's what the state is aiming to do, including doing things like no longer allowing homeowner associations around the state to block these units.
So the big argument against this, again, and we were talking about this in the last hour, is local control, isn't it?
Yeah, local control and sort of, again, local governments and neighborhoods kind of being able to sort of tailor these units or the policies surrounding these units to their own particular circumstances.
Now, these four bills that you've sort of outlined for us very nicely, by the way, prompt me to ask you if what we're talking about here in terms of the legislation is really, as you indicated in your article, a big deal, a major deal.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on, you know, I do want to be clear. I mean, there's been a lot of talk, not just in with these bills, but, prior state, potential state action that failed early this year that was sort of more directly going after the concept of single family home only zoning across California, multiple other jurisdictions around the country, notably the city of Minneapolis and the state of Oregon took steps in recent years to try to, end single family zoning in their areas. Now, again, to be clear, we're not talking about like multi-story apartment complexes in single-family neighborhoods. That's not what these bills do. But certainly, you know, the idea of kind of a plot with a home, a backyard, and a garage on one lot in neighborhoods of that across the state, these sorts of bills.
But you hear these outcries that this is going to end the California dream of the single-family home and all of that sort of thing. Maybe a bit at this point hyperbolic, but nevertheless, advocates are saying, boy, it's a lot better than building apartment buildings. You're hearing a good deal of that, I imagine, aren't you?
Well, it sort of refers back to the idea that homeowners can sort of do more what they want with their properties
yeah.
than anything else. I mean, advocates for this are talking a lot about, homeowners having the ability to make changes to their properties rather than sort of inviting in, developers to kind of change the character of the community, perhaps in a more robust way.
And could you just briefly tell us about SB 50? Because in addition to those four bills, that was a bill that went down, and it would have allowed actually fourplexes in single-family neighborhoods, and small apartment buildings would essentially be allowed, not necessarily in the similar circumstances they are now. In other words, it was shelved. Why was it shelved? And outline it for us, if you could.
Yeah, it was shelved predominantly after fierce pushback from suburban communities across the state who are very concerned about, some of the same local control issues and changes to their neighborhoods that these bills might be ushering in. Although certainly I think everybody would agree that the changes that are offered by this bill are sort of smaller and less direct than what SB 50 would have allowed for.
Liam Dillon is a reporter of the LA Times. Again, he covers affordable housing. And Karen Chappell is here with us in the studio. She's professor of city and regional planning with the University of California, Berkeley. And Karen, I'd like to go right to your sentiment about this win-win, huh?
This is a win-win. This is a way to build up density in the state of California and really to restore the California dream because homeowners from low-income, middle-income, high-income homeowners can build in their backyards and house their families. You know, you won't have to drive to see your grandchildren hours and hours away. They can be in your backyard.
You've said it's sort of like solar panels. I mean, ADUs are like solar panels. They were rare about 15 years ago, and now they're everywhere.
That's right. And I call it distributed density. And it's a form of density that you don't notice on your block. And even with this bill, you're not going to see more than one or two of these per block in California. And we're not going to notice them. And so it's an incremental way to do infill development.
You built, a 450-square-foot cottage?
I do have one.
Back in 2014, I think? Or when was it?
2011.
2011.
I have a low-income senior in there now.
And it's in your backyard in Berkeley.
And it's in my backyard.
So you'd like to see more of these, and you really feel it will indeed make the housing crisis less of a crisis to a great degree, or to what degree?
Yeah, to a certain degree. So there's 8 million homeowners in California. And in all of our surveys, we've seen that maybe 25%, 30% would like to build one of these. Okay, so that's 2 million. But it takes many, many years for folks to get around to it. There's a lot of inertia with home improvement. So, it's going to be, tens or hundreds of thousands in the next 5 years, not 2 million.
Would rent control provisions also be part of this package as we move throughout California? I know you have rent control in Berkeley, but...
Typically your ADUs are exempt. In Berkeley, it's under the Golden Rule. They're exempt. And that's something that I think localities are going to have to resolve one by one on their own.
And the argument that revenue for affordable housing, which is so desperately needed, would somehow go to this instead?
Well, I don't think some cities are electing to have subsidies for affordable housing, but it's been actually slow to take up. Most people don't want to make this into subsidized housing. They want to have flexible housing in their backyard that can be for their in-laws, for their children, maybe occasionally an Airbnb. In some cases, you may see some subsidized units. Maybe cities will provide loans if people will keep it in permanent affordability or affordability for 10 years. But in most cases, this is going to be just affordable by design.
And you also think this prevents gentrification to a great degree,
well,
and displacement?
Exactly. I actually see this as a way your kids are going to be moving into your backyard instead of moving into your neighbor's house and displacing them.
Keep the character of the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Well, let me bring our listeners into this. I know many of you may want to weigh in, and we'd like to hear from you. And let me tell you how you can join the program. Give us a call now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. That number I'll repeat, 866-733-6786. If you'd like to be part of the program, you can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments you might have to forum@kqed.org. And let me bring Susan Kirsch into this. She's here with us in studio as well. She's founder and former president of Livable California, a group which advocates for more local control in housing. So this is not something that's a win-win by your light.
No, it's not a win-win. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to give another point of view and kind of work to change the narrative. And I think at the heart of this is the part of how the introduction, you know, was presented on this topic, that this is the chance for single-family homeowners to build accessory dwelling units. And I understand that initially that's very much how this was introduced. And a lot of people like Karen and others took advantage of that because it was within that realm of granny units and small backyard cottages. But what these recent bills do, which is hardly being noticed or talked about, but which is a part of why many of us are so concerned about this bill, these bills, is that they also remove the need for owner occupancy, which used to be a condition of doing the ADUs. And so whereas many cities in the past, starting as early as 2015, had begun passing their own ordinances to govern what were considered to be small units, what is introduced with these bills without the need for owner occupancy is that these bills are likely to increase the opportunities for corporations to come in to buy the properties. They will then have the main house, and they'll have a second property and a third property on what had formerly been a single-family lot unit.
You're worried about the behemoth corporations, in other words, coming in and really making hay out of this, aren't you?
Absolutely. That this is what Michael Storper, the London economist, calls the financialization of housing. And what we're facing is that risk that whereas owning a house had been a part of the American dream for so long to build the middle class and maintain strong democracy, that these corporate ownerships of massive amounts of housing are going to further erode the middle class, diminish individuals' opportunities to accumulate wealth through home ownership, and ultimately be undermining democracy by the power of the corporations to now buy up our lands that have singly been in the hands of individuals.
I understand the concerns, and we'll hear a response from Karen Chappell on that. But before I go to that, aren't you also concerned about costs with respect to sewer lines and fire and safety?
Oh, yes.
I mean, all of those things come into the picture, don't they?
Yes. Thank you for bringing all the infrastructure costs, which are now going to just be passed back to the cities. And I'll mention one other thing in these laws is that there's only a 4-foot requirement between the property and the property line. Like 4 foot, that's like the size of your front door plus a foot, which means so much of the space to the rear and the sides of these buildings is going to be diminished. What has been grassy spaces that families could enjoy is going to be diminished.
Well, we're hearing from both sides here. Liam Dillon, let me go to you on this. Since you're the journalist and have pretty much recounted both sides, we're going to have either way you look at it, any way you look at it, from the positive side that we're hearing from Karen Chappell, or from the critical and call it negative side from Susan Kirsch, or possible negative
cautionary
side. Cautionary.
Cautionary,
okay.
Cautionary, thank you.
But I'm interested, Liam, in hearing what you have to say, just in terms of massive zoning changes that would have to happen across the state. Cities are going to need to add zone capacity really throughout California, wouldn't they?
Well, when it comes to this, I think one concern that perhaps has been understated is by doing the laws as the state has done over the previous 4 years, making a number of changes to, allowing the construction of these buildings, is that, a number of cities have, after the laws, initial laws in this area passed in 2016, went in and changed their ordinances for what, to kind of conform with state law. Now, sort of have to do that again, right? To now conform with the new state laws that were just passed. And so, it's going to take some time, I think, for the sort of true impacts of these laws to come to fruition, given that, city by city, we're going to have more changes to how they administer this, because the state lawmakers can mandate things all they want. It's still going to be a homeowner walking into their city hall and pulling an actual permit, right? And so figuring out how that's actually going to work is going to take some time.
Yeah, and I ought to mention ADU applications are escalating, but there's a need to inform certainly the citizenry to a better degree, especially about the approval process. And cities are going to really need – well, San Jose has done actually a great deal. Their building permit you can get in about a month and a half or so now. But you have to streamline this as well. Let me go back to you, Karen Chappell, and get some response from what you heard from Susan Kirsch.
Sure. I see this idea about investor-owned housing taking over with the ADU laws as sort of a straw man. I mean, if you look at the rise of investor-owned housing, this was unleashed by the 2008 housing crisis. This is something obviously we need to regulate at the state and federal level, but we can't just blame ADUs. The owner occupancy requirement, eliminating that, was the single most important thing in these bills. In Portland, this is how people got excited about building these things, because it gave them the flexibility to rent out when they needed.
There are actually tours of Portland which include the ADUs in those tours now. I mean, they become kind of a highlight and a source of pride for the city of Portland. And I ought to mention Vancouver is another good example of where this has gone, full bore.
That's right. And, also we have a rental housing crisis. So we desperately need more rental housing. And we have a situation where our middle class can no longer afford to go into homeownership in California. So what are they going to do? We need to have more rental housing while people accumulate the equity to be able to buy.
Let me get some response from Susan Kirsch, and then we'll go to calls. Susan Kirsch?
Well, yeah, I've got two things to say about that. One, I printed out, because it just came yesterday, a flyer that I got on email, and I get one a couple of times a week. This is with the heading, High Demand for Your Properties Just Like Yours, Review Inquiries, Multiple buyers interested in your home, view pending cash offers. We buy homes for cash, no closing costs or realtor fees. And these are the kinds of notices I think that are going out to a whole lot of people in terms of wanting to, and especially for seniors or people who want to sell. I'll mention one other thing. I did a little survey in anticipation of this show, talking to some of the elected officials and community leaders who I know, and asked a couple of things, and I'll be brief about this. One was to say, did your city already have ordinances governing ADUs? And 100% of the people I talked to said yes. I asked, are these adequate, needing improvement or just really inadequate? And everybody said that they were adequate to what they were governing within their own cities. So I think we have one thing to say. Cities have been doing a job and working at that level of knowing what the infrastructure needs are, as well as community character, to be able to do that. When asked, did your legislature seek any input from any of your city councils in terms of what they should take into account of what was already working in city ordinances? Not one had heard from any legislators. And when asked, do you anticipate favorable, unfavorable, or unsure outcomes? Most of the people said unfavorable, saying, I'm always concerned when state steps on local control.
All right. I want to bring some callers aboard, and let me begin with Mike. Mike, join us. You're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering if you guys thought that this was going to trigger a tax reassessment if I were to install an ADU. That would represent a big jump in my property taxes.
Yeah. What do you see on the horizon there, Liam Dillon? I want to go to you on that.
Sure. Obviously, the underlying land, because of Prop 13 protections, won't change. But when you make a substantial, improvement on your property, there is a chance, certainly, that that a portion of your property's value will go up. That could then be reassessed. So I can't, obviously, not knowing the specifics, I can't give any sort of
Karen Chappell had something she wanted to bring into this picture.
I can tell you, as a homeowner who's built a ADU, my property taxes went up. I got reassessed. It went up by $50 a month.
Okay, let me bring another caller aboard. I think that was Mike. Thank you for the call. And let me go to another caller. That's Molly joining us from Oakland. Molly, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I was curious if there are going to be any safeguards to ensure that these ADUs are in fact used strictly for housing. It seems like a lot of Airbnbs are kind of sucking up available housing and really having an impact on the housing crisis.
Yeah, I'm going to go back to you on this, Liam, because you've written about this.
Yeah, I think it depends on what the individual policy of any individual city is. Certainly, cities have up and down the state have done things to limit or restrict vacation rentals, such as Airbnb, and so these would fall under whatever policies that local governments would want to have.
But Susan Kirsch, this is again tied in with some of your concerns. We could go the way of Airbnb. You're talking about corporate control.
Well, yes, it's interesting for Airbnb. I have an Airbnb in my small home in Mill Valley. I pay 12% tax on that, a transit-oriented development tax, every month. So the idea that people would put in accessory dwelling units and not be able to not have to pay any of those kinds of fees is just interesting to me, and a kind of inequity that exists in the system.
Karen Chappell.
When we surveyed homeowners in Portland, Seattle, and Vancouver about Airbnb use, we found that 10% did rotate their housing in and out of Airbnb. 60% were using it for longer-term rental housing.
Just an interesting number, 30% of the homes I had mentioned in Vancouver earlier are ADU. I'm just coining a new neologism here, our ADU'd. But 30% is really high. That's about, just take 10% here in the Bay Area, it would mean 150,000 additional homes. Question from a listener, how do tiny homes on wheels fit into the ADU legislation? Liam Dillon, can I go to you on that?
Yeah, I mean, again, as far as what the actual, I don't know about, whether wheels on a house would trigger anything different. I can tell you, though, right now allowed under these rules is at least one other home that would measure 800 square feet. That's the sort of the minimum that cities would have to allow on these properties.
And another listener asks, what about homeowners with unlicensed existing in-law units? Many would like to license these old units, but the process is extremely expensive, especially to get them up to 2019 new unit standards. Is there a proposal for amnesty so that these homeowners can come into compliance? Do you know, Liam, if this is grandfathered?
So again, I think it's locality by locality. I can tell you in Los Angeles, this was a big thing that happened in recent years when these new state laws went into effect. You've seen permit applications go up 2,000%. So a number of those homes have been grandfathered in, but also a number of new permit requests as well.
And Sharon writes, if I were a homeowner with the means to do this, the motivation would be to house a family member. Another listener, Kai, writes, don't drop rent control, and I'd consider having an accessory dwelling unit. We're getting all kinds of range of comments here, and we'll hear more from you, our listeners, when we return. We're also going to hear from Steve Vallejos, who actually builds these things in backyards. Stay tuned. That's all up ahead. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and we're talking about bills that are attempting to reach California housing and the housing goals that we have through accessory dwelling units. And with us here in studio is Susan Kirsch. She's the founder and former president of Livable California, a group which advocates for local control in housing, and Karen Chappell, who's professor of city and regional planning at UC Berkeley. I also have Liam Dillon on the line, reporter for the LA Times, who covers affordable housing. And I'm going to go to a comment here and get your response, if I could, Karen Chappell. It's from Nancy, who says, One state mandated size does not fit all. Local control must be maintained to work with the community to achieve regulations for successful ADUs. Removing open space in the backyard destroys the fabric of family-oriented neighborhoods and turns our streets into corporation-run real estate investments. Please don't tell me this plan will help solve the housing crisis when there are no rules to keep the greedy ones in check and the rents affordable.
So this is a state legislation that provides a framework for local cities to design their own ordinances that work for their places. So I think there's plenty of room left here for local autonomy, local design regulations, and so forth. In fact, when we just did an evaluation, right now we're grading 200 ordinances around the state, and we found that actually localities, despite the new state laws, had taken the advantage of the opportunity to actually make their ADU ordinances more stringent in some cases, and they had minimum lot sizes that really prohibited low-income homeowners from building at all.
This does not necessarily comfort your concerns, Susan Kirsch?
Well, it doesn't comfort my concerns. You know, I've been concerned about local control for bills that have been passed around housing and undermining local control for some time, for some number of years, because every year, as Liam pointed out at the beginning, there have been bills that undercut that. You know, I brought with me another resource that I just want to put out there, a book called Captured, The Corporate Infiltration of American Democracy, which is including how our legislators, our Supreme Courts, our media, so many aspects of America that we have counted on to keep balance in what we're doing are being undermined by corporate power. And I think this is an example where we should not say, oh, there, it's going to be fine. When we had local legislation that was governing ordinances, I think we have to ask, why did state legislators jump on this bandwagon to further undermine what communities were already doing?
You think they're being lobbied for this? Do you have
I
any evidence of that?
Absolutely being lobbied for it. And I think we have evidence in it going back to Plan Bay Area and the CASA Compact, CASA being the one that was the fermenting ground for bringing forward like at least 10 of the housing, of the 18 housing bills that were passed this term.
Here's a listener named Maureen who writes, we did this last year in Menlo Park. Grandparents, mom, dad, and a two-year-old living in what we now call the compound. Extended family living together really makes sense for us, but having dedicated separate spaces is what makes it work. And there's Tricia who writes, folks would be more willing to rent on their property if there were a code of behavior that tenants had to follow. Therefore, there could be more housing. Current tenant protections allow destructive and intolerable behavior that homeowners should not have to tolerate. A real concern as you see things, Susan Kirsch?
Well, I like the idea of the compound, and I think that's a part of what might have been celebrated back in the early days of ADUs being proposed, and that the concern is more that there will not be anybody of the family who's living in these three units that are now on the property, filling up all the space, and that it's going to be the outside investors who have a property that generates return on investment for themselves and the people whose investments they're representing, and that they will always be working to get top dollar on what they've invested in.
Let me read a couple more comments and get your response, Karen Chappell. This is Bill writes, Bill who writes, people contemplating converting a garage to a living space should be aware that the new state law will not relax the strict construction codes that most cities and towns zealously enforce. And Al says, what about homeowners with unlicensed existing in-law units? Many would like to license these old units, but the process is extremely expensive, especially to get them up to 2019 new unit standards. So, we're getting into this question about amnesty for homeowners who can come into compliance. But I'd like you to address really Bill's comments, first of all, that the new state law will relax strict construction codes, his concerns.
So the building code is sort of the next frontier here in terms of building housing in California, because we have such a stringent building code. And right now we have a building code that is for McMansion single family houses on detached lots. And we need to get a building code that works for smaller dwellings, and amnesty as well. We're never going to be able to get to legalize all those units and make them safe. 15% of houses in Berkeley already have granny flats, and we need to be able to have a path to legality. Cities like Santa Cruz are working hard to make this possible by giving homeowners assistance, technical assistance, loans, and so forth to legalize their backyard units.
There's a lot of range, though, with these ADUs. I'm thinking about the fact that, you've got 150 square feet to 1,200, when it comes to some of these units. And actually, I think up in the rural areas, there was one that measured a couple thousand square feet. Should this be more standardized?
I actually go against standardizing it because our neighborhoods in California are so unique, and every lot is very different. So we need to have all shapes and sizes for
Doesn't that suggest local control?
Oh, in this, there will be, you have an option as how big you want to build your unit. You can build, you have to have a minimum size, but there's a big range there. There's a lot of room to play here.
And speaking of a lot of room to play, well, actually, let me read a comment here from Aaron, who writes, "People need somewhere to live. It is the height of liberal hypocrisy to decry the homeless tent camps and complain about how no one can afford to live in the Bay Area while being against anything that brings greater density. We're all going to have to sacrifice some comfort if we truly want to express our values." And you say what, Susan Kirsch?
Well, I sympathize with that sentiment, and I think there's reason to be concerned, especially as we see more and more homeless camps being created. But what current research is showing is that higher density and tearing down the old and affordable to build the new often means that it's becoming new and unaffordable. So I think the research is showing that higher density and infill and many of these provisions are not making it more cost effective to live in the area, but it's actually increasing the cost to live here.
Let me bring another caller aboard, and that's you, Tracy. Join us. You're on the air.
Yeah, Tracy from San Francisco. In your discussions about adding an ADU, I think there's a fundamental issue here about how the listeners really need to understand that it turns a single-family resident into a multi-unit building. And this changes the applicability of, applying the local rent law, state laws, tremendously from a single-family resident to being subjected to something like the local rent board, which in San Francisco here can be brutal and severely problematic. So I think this is where this could be heading if these things are just added. And maybe you can address that.
Who would like to address that? Actually, Liam Dillon, do you want to address it?
Sure. I'm lucky to have called the San Francisco city to talk about this when I'm writing my story, so I do have a little bit of context. So yes, it is true. San Francisco actually encourages and tries to ensure that those who are building these new units in their neighborhoods, for them to fall under rent control, the new units. And so they call it a way to, further add to their rent control housing stock. And so that certainly is, a benefit, I would say, for renters who would be living in them, but obviously also a concern for property owners who should certainly be aware that there may be restrictions on how much they're able to charge for these units.
And again, Liam Dillon is a reporter of the LA Times. He covers affordable housing. He does write about the Bay Area, and we'll take some more of your calls. Let me go next to James in Vallejo. James, welcome to the program. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you, Michael. So I worked as a planner and a property tax appraiser, so I have a few different points to make about this. Prior to this bill, there were ADU units allowed in various communities already. What has changed is that now that people don't have to live on the property where they build the ADU, that's a significant change. And it, as Susan points out, that invites investors into the whole scene, and they're going to come in with cash and they're going to buy a property. And they're going to turn it into rental properties with two units. So that really fundamentally changes the whole idea of what single-family housing was in some communities. And while in places like Berkeley, where there's already a lot of people...
James, I'm sorry to break in here, but the call is kind of muffled. We're not getting a clear sense of... I think I know what you're really wanting to communicate here, but you're just not coming out with clarity for us, and I'm sorry about that. I wanted also to bring Steve Vallejos into this, as I said I would do earlier. He's president of Prefab ADU, and Steve, welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Thank you. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, let's just start with, okay, I'm in the market for and want to build an ADU. Where do I start?
Well, the good news is that after the change in the 2017 legislation, the number of ADU solutions providers is growing rapidly. So there are a lot of resources out there. I normally would say that there are a handful of different places that you can start. I often recommend that homeowners start within their city or county, depending on where their house jurisdiction is, to get a better understanding of what is allowed and what the process is within the local municipality, because that really helps set the stage of a better understanding of what you can do in your property. And most of those cities, their planning departments are really helpful in, you know, letting you know what you specifically can do on your property. So I think that's a tremendous place to start. Then from there, there's a lot of architects, contractors and organizations like us, which are full turnkey solutions providers that can answer questions either directly on the phone or through email inquiries or website inquiries. So there's a lot of resources out there now to help.
And talk about the units themselves and what they look like. Do they have separate rooms?
There's an array of solutions out there. You can subscribe to a solution that is a studio configuration, where it's basically a one-room configuration, and the only other enclosed spaces would be like a closet and the bathroom. And then there's an array of solutions from one to two bedrooms. There's solutions with lofts. So there's a variety of solutions that you could pursue depending on, you know, what can physically work on your
property. So do research and do shopping and find out as much as you can. But let's find out from you how big these units can be. And can you give me a range about how much they cost, or like the smallest unit would cost what?
So the way the code works right now in California is that the smallest unit allowed is 150 square feet, and that's considered what the state calls an efficiency unit. And the largest unit allowed by state code is 1,200 square feet. Now, it's up to each individual city to adopt their rules for what they considered allowable within their city. And some cities put restriction on the total size, so they may not allow up to 1,200 square feet. So, yes, there's a wide array of sizes, and then a lot of resources out there that can help accommodate you depending on what you're pursuing. I will tell you from my perspective of what I know and what we do is our smallest unit is 150 square foot unit, and it starts off completely installed at about $65,000. And then we have, you know, full size units up to 1,200 square feet that, you know, can range up to $420,000. But to focus more on how we dig into answering that more specifically for clients, the $66,000 unit or $65,000 unit, micro unit in the Bay Area could run maybe $315 a month if you add that to your first mortgage. In major parts of the Bay Area, the market rent on that unit is anywhere between $950 to upwards of $2,200 in places like San Francisco. So in terms of looking at the cash flow potential, in most cases, it's more than, you know, 65% profitable, on the lower end and significantly higher.
Well, I know your company does a lot of design and permit approvals and sewer and electricity hookups and so forth, and you're going to actually be doing some kits over time and DIYs, that is, do your own for people.
We're actually already doing that. What we're actually extending that into now is that we're working with cities to get a handful of products pre-approved so that the it significantly cuts down the cost of doing the design and submittal, and then it also significantly cuts down the time required for the cities to review it. So the end goal is to find ways to make it, you know, faster, cheaper, and easier for the consumer. And that's, doing this for 14 years, that's always been, you know, our primary goals.
Well, it's good of you to join us this morning, and appreciate the work you do, and thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Yeah. And Steve Vallejos, he's president of Prefab ADU, and we're going to continue taking your calls. Let me go next to Alex, who is joining us from San Jose. Alex, you're on the air. Morning.
Yes. So my question.
I don't know what happened to Alex. Try back again if you would, Alex. You simply didn't come through there. I'm sorry. I'm going to go to another. Alex, are you there? Alex? I know we're having some concerns here with the phones, obviously. Try to get your calls on as best we can, but let me go to some comments here. Dean writes, keep the character of the neighborhood is such disgustingly coded language. Why must our neighborhoods forever be defined by the aesthetic preferences of previous generations? We're forcing young people to flee or forever live paycheck to paycheck. Susan Kirsch.
Well, I know the label that often gets put on that kind of behavior is called NIMBY behavior, as if that's a real negative. And I think there's a real need to rephrase the understanding of that, and that there are many people who are operating as stewards of what's happening in the community with a broader perspective of that, and not just in the community, but through even, you know, nine county Bay Area regional or state, and that there's the way things change for people depending on the age that they're in. And I understand from my own younger children who, you know, a son who's very happy living in the middle of Berkeley in an apartment, and that works fine for him. But understanding as our children age, they are more likely to want to have families and children and live in areas that are suitable with playgrounds and parks and backyards for slip and slide and playing little baseball practices in the backyard. So, and then eventually as we age more, maybe for many seniors, being able to age in place, living in an ADU at the back of the family compound would be really appealing. So,
well, we've been outlining all the positives and negatives of this, but one thing that we shouldn't ignore, and let me go to you on this, Karen Chappell, is the fact that if you have more housing built on properties, you already have the infrastructure there, but you also have a better way to fight climate change because there's less sprawl.
That's right. And so distributed density is a way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. One of the things that's going on here is that we've made it much easier to build within a half mile transit and by reducing parking requirements there. So that, you know, that means the density is going where it should be. And there will be California, you know, we overbuilt tremendously our single-family housing. We've overbuilt now luxury apartments on the very high end. And so this is sort of the missing middle that we need to fill in our neighborhoods and keep them diverse and make the physical, the urban form, more diverse.
I'm going to go to a comment here from Alexander, one of our listeners, Liam Dillon, and he puts it in a bifurcated way that I'm curious to get your response to. He says, you can have fair, affordable housing for everyone, or you can have investment housing that makes the rich richer. Does that strike a chord with you, Liam, or is that too...
Well, I mean, that seems a bit of a
too simplistic,
strong of an either or. You know, there's a lot of research that suggests that, generally speaking, California is in a shortage of available housing, and so certainly proponents of this type of housing say housing is good, and there should be more of it. And so that's sort of one perspective. I suppose the other perspective is that if you are only allowing building at the high end or building that perhaps isn't for folks who are currently living in communities, then you could perhaps exacerbate some of the problems that are existing right now.
And Susan Kirsch?
Well, I just want to bring in with this idea of the rich getting richer, a study that I found that an analysis showed that the top 1% gained $21 trillion in wealth since 1989, while the bottom half lost $900 billion. So the proportion of the even smaller portion of the 1% that is acquiring wealth through corporatized housing and corporatizing so many things is a real danger, I think, for all of us. Above and beyond what we have as a housing affordability issue, we have a middle class crisis, a crisis in democracy.
I read a comment from Tim who writes, the real problems are the tech companies that are truly creating this job and housing imbalance. Shouldn't they be required to build affordable housing on their campuses to help offset the issues they have created? And we bring another caller on. Roxanne joins us next. Roxanne, welcome.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
My concern, I'm calling from Menlo Park, and my concern is the increase of remodels, and I suspect ADUs and garage conversions without permits. And, you know, when is the limit? What if the first half of the block wants to do ADUs? You know, who's monitoring the hours of operation, or, you know, businesses moving in, congregations moving in? Who monitors all this?
Yeah, I think you've been hearing some of those concerns, haven't you, Liam?
Well, I think, sure, but that goes back to sort of any housing anywhere or in any state local building department, right? I do think some of the supporters of this will say, look, if you're only allowed to build single-family houses on some of these lands, then you're going to get redevelopment that is going to be, you know, these giant mansions, right? And so supporters would argue that if you allow for multiple units, you could perhaps get, you know, as many as three homes on the same piece of land.
And I thank the caller and go on to another caller. Kyle, that's you. Thank you for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you. So my family got priced out of the Bay Area back in the 90s. And largely speaking, I've claimed that on the landed gentry that wouldn't approve measures to help our schools. And just generally we're making it difficult for families because no one would allow building apartments, which would give upward mobility. And so as I look at this housing shortage, I have to wonder, like, who's benefiting from having a housing scarcity? It kind of seems like it's the homeowners.
The point well taken, and I thank you for that call. And let me read a comment from a member of the Berkeley City Council who says, I'm an elected representative in Berkeley, and we desperately need state intervention to allow residents to build ADUs. Lawmakers asked for, and I provided my input. I've tried for years to make it easier, and these state laws have helped more than anything. Okay. we're hearing arguments pro and con. Let me cut to the chase here, and let me go to you on this, if I could, Karen Chappell, again. What do you say about this concern Susan Kirsch has about the big businesses coming in and really playing such a significant and possible integral role in all of this, a predominant role?
So yeah, I really see this as spin. So here we have a set of bills that are the biggest step that California has taken towards empowering homeowners, and not just the rich homeowners in the exclusive communities in Marin and so forth, but your ordinary run-of-the-mill, low-income homeowner, middle-class homeowner.
Which could mean more income for them.
Is going to have a strategy to build it, to get some income and stay in place.
Let me go to you again, Susan Kirsch.
Well, and if there were a provision that required owner occupancy on any property that was bringing in ADUs, I think that would go a long way towards assuring people that these are not going to become corporate estates with corporate fund capacity to be generating profit without care and even ownership and residency within the community that the units are built in.
And here's Cheryl. Cheryl, join us. Welcome. You're on the air.
Oh, hello. Yes. Thank you for taking my call. I am a retired nurse. I'm 65. I've lived in the area for 40 years. I'm being priced out. I can't afford to live here anymore. And the units that I can afford, I'm looking at a lot of these units that have been thrown together without permits. They're called studios and et cetera, but they are up substandard. They are not built well. And this is a major concern for me. They are moldy. They're not insulated. They're not on a decent foundation. This is such a big problem in this damp area where mold manifests, et cetera, et cetera. I have always been able to live in decent housing, and I am no longer able to. And the greed, the greed and selfishness that I am coming against in this area is just shameful.
I'm sorry for what you're going through, and I thank you for the call. And let me go to you on this, Liam Dillon. What have you been finding along these lines from your reporting?
Well, I mean, I think people are going to find a way to live somewhere near their job. I mean, or near where they want to be, no matter what. And when you have a scarcity of housing, it certainly has incentives for, you know, landlords and others to not necessarily have to keep their properties up to the best code, because they're going to be able to find someone who's willing to live with the mold or willing to live with potentially unsafe conditions, because that's the only other options they have. And so, you know, certainly, a lack of housing where people want to be, leads to these sort of downstream problems that I think you're going to see, certainly, more so than if there were more housing available.
Well, you know, I said you do write about the Bay Area, and you specifically write about a little town here in the South Bay called Saratoga, which represents some of the concerns that people have about building these units. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so I spoke with the elected official in Saratoga who was concerned that if some of these sort of parking requirements were to go away, that would really change some of the nature of those individual neighborhoods. I'm also concerned that, look, he said that the city itself has been incentivizing ADU or casita production for a number of years, and so they really aren't the problem. The concern should be we're looking at jurisdictions that aren't trying to do this.
And let me bring another caller here. Let's go to you, Teresa. Thank you for waiting. Join us.
Hi. You know, I was listening to the radio, and I actually just bought a single-family home in San Francisco in March, and I'm building an ADU currently. And so I just wanted to call. It's such an interesting topic.
Well, tell us about your ADU.
So I hired an architect, and we're doing the permitting for it. And there's actually three different kinds you can get. Only one of them is subject to rent control. The other two are not, but my house is also RH2, so that means it can have a separate residency too. But yeah, and it's just such, I don't know, it's so exciting. I've lived in the Bay for like 20 years. I had a rent-controlled apartment that I got bought out of. That's how I put the down payment down on my house. So I totally support, you know, rent control and affordable housing. I'm in this totally different situation right now.
Well, congratulations for the home purchase. And as my mother would say, you should live in it in good health. And thank you for the call. I'm going to have to probably wrap it up here. Final word from Karen Chappell and Susan Kirsch, just seconds left here. You've been gung-ho. Susan, you want to say anything additionally here? Karen, you've been gung-ho. Go ahead. Final word.
I just hope we see the state next move towards enabling and targeting really low-income homeowners to help prevent foreclosure and get them an income stream. And that's going to take revolutionizing finance for the ADUs. That's the next step.
Susan Kirsch?
I would just conclude with the champion being a champion, all of us being champions for local control, and also saying not to forget the cause of this problem is often that we need 2 housing units per 1,000 square foot of commercial space, and businesses are not doing their fair share in getting all of the jobs and not filling the housing needs.
We'll leave it there. Thank you, Susan. Thank you, Karen. Thank you, Liam Dillon and Steve Alejos. And thank you, our listeners. We would not be here without you. And we're here with you every Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour repeats 10 to 11 in the evening. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.